there anything I need to do to activate the elbow?
I don't know.
Okay. All right, well.
Reserving 3 minutes for the rebuttal, Your Honor.
All right, and please identify yourself.
Doug Palmer, representing Ms. Koval with Mr. Fowler's co-counsel. This appeal is about multiple proximate cause. All the parties agree that we are in a multiple proximate cause state. All the parties agree that we take our injured workers as we find them, and this is a workers' compensation appeal.
I want to explore the multiple proximate cause argument. It seems to me that the employer's argument was that she had a well-established pre-existing condition that was degenerative, all other things being equal.
Yes.
And that her knee pain was going to continue and get worse, whether or not there was any accident or not. So how is that a multiple proximate cause issue?
Because
you're saying it would have happened regardless.
Because in workers' compensation cases, the focus is supposed to be on is the injury still a cause? So if it's progressing regardless, but you also have the injury is also a cause, there are multiple causes for her ongoing knee pain. And I think this, and I did not cite to this, I thought about this case this morning. In the Shea case, Shea versus the Department of Labor and Industries, 12 Washap 410, 1974, that was, again, 12 Washap 410, 1974, there was admitted two causes of a worker's disability. And the issue is because a non-industrial condition was also sufficient to cause total disability, is it irrelevant that the injury also was a cause of the total disability? And the court's answer was no, the focus is on the injury. If you have multiple causes, as long as the injury is a cause, you can recover benefits.
Well, there was a multiple proximate cause instruction.
There was.
And could the jury have concluded that the industrial accidents, the two falls, was not the cause of that?
They could have. They could have decided that the injuries were no longer a cause. But the problem here with this instruction is this optional language provided sua sponte by the court was that there may be no recovery. This is the bracket language. No recovery for any injuries or disabilities that would have resulted from the natural progression of the pre-existing. So
what do you mean when you say it was provided sua sponte? It is a bracketed item.
It is a bracketed plaintiff. Ms. Koval presented the instruction without the optional language. Defense counsel said, we don't want it, the instruction at all. And the court said, oh, hey, I'm going to give the instruction and I'm going to include the optional language. No party asked for the optional language.
Now, if you were going to write the instruction in a way that you felt would be accepted as fair to both parties an appellate court or by a trial court, how would you have written it?
I would have simply excluded the optional sentence because
well,
the optional.
That then, I asked you if fair to both parties. I mean, in other words, as I understand the instruction, the first part of it, the part you like, is the one that brings in the idea of a pre-existing condition.
Yes.
Right, and so, but you don't like the other one because it gives the employer an opportunity to argue.
What that optional language is for apportionment. That's what the comments to the instructions say. That's what the TORNO, T-O-R-N-O, case talks about is apportionment. And in workers' compensation, there is no apportionment. There's no opportunity for the court, for the jury to say 75% here, 25% there, 80,000 there, 20,000 here. The special verdict form is a series of yes or no questions. Is the worker disabled due to the injury? Yes or no. Is the worker entitled to further treatment? Yes or no. Is the board correct? Yes or no. And this instruction, this optional language says there may be no recovery. It is instructing them.
Or it could be consistent with a finding by the jury that both of the accidents were not a proximate cause of her pain.
It could, but it also could be consistent with the jury saying we have and we have the injury as a cause, we have the second injury as a cause, we have the weight as a cause, and we have the natural progression as a cause. And because we're finding the natural progression is a cause, this optional language says there can be no recovery. So this instruction is telling them to agree with the board in the special verdict form And because the verdict form says, was the board correct in saying that there is no disability or no need for further treatment? It's a yes.
Well, it sounds like what you're saying is that you think that the last sentence, the bracketed sentence, was true, that a jury could apply that, but what aren't you arguing that it cut them off from thinking about your position?
I'm saying that this optional language does nothing to further the defense theory of the case. They can still argue under the standard proximate cause instruction their theory of the case. The injuries are no longer a cause. What this instruction does is takes it a step further, which is maybe appropriate in a general PI case, tort case, where you can apportion damages. But here, it's saying there's a third outcome. There's a third outcome possible. It's not just a binary yes or no, but says, hey, look, so long as there is some natural progression, regardless if there's also cause from the injury, that there can be no recovery.
Is your position, let's say there are four proximate causes here.
Yes.
In this case, including the two slips and falls or whatever.
Yeah.
You're saying because of the broad interpretation of the Industrial Act that then she is entitled to recover, even though the pre-existing condition may have naturally worsened?
Correct.
And is there a case that says that?
Shea
is your case, which was not cited in the brief.
I apologize for that. I just thought of it this morning. Is the Shea case? Okay.
So your argument really turns on the difference between a PI case and a workers' comp case.
Correct, because a workers' comp case is binary. Either you're entitled to benefits or you're not entitled to benefits. And the Dennis decision, and there are cases. The Wendt decision talks about the eggshell doctrine. The Dennis decision.
Well, isn't that true in a PI case? I mean, you're entitled to recovery or you're not entitled to recovery.
Except that in a PI case, and again, I'm not a PI attorney. I don't practice that area of the law, so I'm going outside my scope of expertise here. But this language, as suggested in Torno and in the comments, this optional language is used for apportionment.
Well, but if
we don't have apportionment in workers' compensation when we're talking about temporary total disability and medical treatment.
A jury couldn't assign a percentage of liability to Ms. Carville if this was a PI case simply because she had a pre-existing condition, could they?
This language suggests that they wouldn't not just because she had a pre-existing condition, but because she had a pre-existing condition which naturally progressed, independent of the injury.
I don't want to eat into your rebuttal time.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Ryan Miller, and I represent the respondent, Auburn Regional Medical Center. I request that 6 minutes be allocated to myself and 4 minutes be allocated to the Department of Labor and Industries Council, Mr. Steve Vineyard. I would like to focus on the first issue that was brought up here today, and Department's Council would like to focus on the second issue, if that's okay with your honors.
Well, I was looking at the exceptions to the jury instructions this morning. It does look like the claimant wanted this instruction. It wasn't proposed by the self-insured employer. The court said, I think I should include all the language. What's your position on whether you objected to that or wanted that part of the instruction?
It is true that the claimant wanted the instruction. It is also true that the self-insured employer did not object to the instruction. And the reason is that the last language is actually a true statement of the law. When you review that last sentence in jury instruction number 10, it indicates there may be no recovery, however, for any injuries or disabilities that would have resulted from natural progression of the pre-existing condition. That's a true statement of the law. There has to be a proximate causation link between the industrial injury and the pre-existing condition.
What about the claimant's argument here just now that if, let's say there's multiple causations,
yes,
and one of them isn't the industrial accident, and there may be others such as this degenerative condition, and she still recovers?
That's true. If there is a proximate cause if there's a lighting up, if there's an aggravation or anything like that, then it's covered under the Industrial Insurance Act.
So your position, what is your position then as to why this is an error in this case?
Okay. My position is that, let me take a step back here in my argument. First of all, it's well established that it's within the trial court's discretion whether to give a particular jury instruction. As was also indicated in the briefing, jury instructions are sufficient when they allow counsel to argue their theory of the case are not misleading and read as a whole properly informed the jury of the appellate applicable law. That's what happened here. We have jury instruction number 8.
Let me ask about the wording of this. It seems to indicate that if there's a pre-existing condition and it would ever have come about, then there can't be a recovery, right? On its own, it ever would have come about.
I don't think that's true.
Would have resulted from natural progression of the pre-existing condition even without this occurrence.
That's a true statement of the law.
Okay. What if it happened faster than it otherwise would have? To the same degree, but it happened faster.
Right. That would be an aggravation, and that would be allowable. But, again, we read jury instruction.
So that's not within it. So it is both the extent of the injury and the timing of the symptoms that is covered by the sentence?
The way it works is that if the industrial injury in any way caused aggravation or acceleration or lit up a degenerative disease, like here it's in the knee, then that would be covered in the Industrial Insurance Act.
So this sentence only applies if it's shown that it had no impact whatsoever on the timing or the extent of the outcome.
That's correct. And that's what I believe the sentence says. And as we know, we read jury instructions as a whole. We don't read them piecemeal. And instruction number 8, specifically and correctly, and no party is alleging otherwise, is a correct proximate cause instruction under the law. And
what do you think of the argument that says that, I think counsel was just saying that, well, this is different from a personal injury case. I mean, I gather that this is a standard personal injury instruction, and I gather his argument is that it's never really been approved in an L&I case and shouldn't be, because in L&I there's no apportionment in the way that there may be in a proximate cause, I mean, in a personal injury case.
Yeah.
What do you think of that argument?
Well, I think that, first of all, the jury wouldn't know any of that. They're simply looking at the words in the jury instruction, and the words in the jury instruction are true. If there's any injury or disability that would have resulted from the natural progression, then regardless of the injury, then it's not covered. In terms of...
You think it could be better worded?
Your Honor, I suppose it could be better worded. However, I don't have that recommendation for this court at this time.
The court also gave instruction number 11, which talks about aggravation. How does 11 and 10 and 8 all fit together?
So 8 is essentially that there can be a cause. Number 10 essentially indicates that you take a worker as you find them. That's that eggshell skull doctrine, of course. And then number 11 just talks about that the industrial injury can cause an aggravation of a pre-existing condition that would be covered as well.
So but this, the employer's position here was that whatever injury was caused by the accidents had resolved, right? And so there was no ongoing issue. Am I understanding your position right on that?
That's exactly correct, Your Honor.
So there was no issue with the industrial injury being a proximate cause of the pain and suffering.
Or the alleged disability. And Your Honor, to be fair, that's the employer's position.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, let's say the employer's evidence was that the leg would have fallen off after 20 years of its own.
Yeah.
But because of the occurrence, the leg fell off at 10 years.
Yeah.
Does he get the difference between 10 and 20, or does he get the value of the leg falling off?
Well,
how does this work?
It's all covered. If the industrial injury is a cause, okay, it's covered. In conclusion, the respondent, Auburn Regional Medical Center, respectfully requests this court to affirm the judgment of the Superior Court and deny Ms. Koval another trial. Thank you so much for your time, Your Honors.
Excuse me. Steve Vineyard, Assistant Attorney General for the Department of Labor and Industries. And I guess I want to make clear at the outset, the department in its brief addressed only the issue of whether the vocational evidence was improperly excluded, and that's the only issue I'm addressing today. And I realize that hasn't been the focus of the argument so far, but I have to speak on that issue because that's the issue my client wants me to address. And this court should uphold the Superior Court's ruling admitting only some evidence that no vocational assessment was done for two reasons. First, Koval's argument that a claim can never be closed unless a vocational assessment has been done lacks merit and has no support in the statute. Second, the ruling, the evidentiary ruling, did not preclude Koval because it did not actually prevent her from making any argument she wished to make.
I thought the department's position in the brief was you didn't want us to reach the statutory issue.
It's unnecessary for the court to reach it, and that remains my argument now, because it was not prejudicial, because there was evidence that no vocational assessment was done. But I guess in an abundance of caution, I also want to address the merits of the argument and not give any sort of appearance that the department's shying away from sort of the merits of the case or the merits of the underlying issue. But, yes, certainly the court could appropriately conclude that it isn't necessary to reach it because it wasn't prejudicial in this case and not even get into the merits. Both are true in this case. But the Industrial Insurance Act grants the department the sole discretion to provide vocational assistance. It also provides that after receiving a report from a vocational professional, the department may provide vocational assistance to an injured worker. But nowhere does the statute say that the department cannot close an injured worker's claim without a vocational report. And that really is the essence of the worker's argument in this case, and the statute does not provide that right. If the legislature had intended to create an enforceable legal right to have a vocational assessment be done, it could have easily written the statute to say that, and the statute does not say that.
What about the interrelationship between the WAC and the statute?
What the WAC sets out is the process the department uses when it provides vocational services. It also sets out the types of reports that the department reviews and how it uses them in making decisions. But to cut a long story short, nowhere do the WAC say that a vocational assessment absolutely has to be done in all cases. Now, in a reply brief, Koval narrows her theory and says, well, they're not necessary in all cases, and they're not necessary if a worker can work without restrictions or if they actually return to work. But in the other cases, they are necessary. And although that's a narrower version of her argument, it still lacks support in the statute. And if anything, I think it sort of highlights the fact that this argument is disconnected to the statute, because nowhere is the statute making these sorts of distinctions of saying sometimes reports are absolutely mandatory and other times they aren't. The statute simply does not create a legally enforceable right to have an assessment done. Now, jumping back to the additional issue that the court raised, the ruling was not actually prejudicial in this case because although some of the evidence regarding this issue was excluded, other evidence was given to the jury that no vocational assessment had been done. And based on that evidence, Koval certainly could have made the argument. I mean, the department would have disagreed with it had it participated. The employer presumably would have disagreed with it. But the argument could have been made, and the worker didn't make the argument. So the worker waived the underlying issue that this whole evidentiary ruling hinges on, and therefore cannot show that the ruling was prejudicial error, and this court does not need to address the issue. But if it does decide to address it, either in dicta or otherwise, the department would ask that the court reject the argument as it is not supported by the statute. The department asks that this court uphold the evidentiary ruling. Thank you.
Well, time. Thank you.
Dealing with the first argument first, Your Honors, this optional language was not defense counsel's theory of the case. Their medical evidence was that there was no proximate cause from the injury and that this was solely the natural progression.
Well, isn't that what the sentence says, though?
No, it's not. It says there can be no recovery if the that would have resulted from the natural progression. So that implies implicitly that if there is some natural progression, there can be no recovery. So, and at least it's unclear on that part, and it leaves it open for the jury to be confused on that point of law. And that is an important point of law in multiple proximate cause. That is the essence of multiple proximate cause. It's so long as there is some cause from the injury, even if there's some cause other places. The issues of acceleration and lighting up, those are what instructions number 10 and 11 go to without this optional language. 10 is about lighting up. There's no prior symptoms. That's what if you find. Number 11 goes to the acceleration argument. It allowed everybody to argue this case. The optional language was something nobody asked for, and it was not part of anybody's theory of the case, but was confusing, but was highly potential for confusing the jury, even with the proximate cause instruction number 8, to say, well, we find some natural progression. What do we do now?
Is there not evidence in this record for a jury to conclude that the industrial injuries accidents was not a proximate cause?
There is that potential, but this optional language does nothing with that.
Have you thought about rewarding it? Did you think at the time that you would like to reward it or offer any option?
We thought that the entire language was unnecessary.
I understand that.
But we did not think about rewording that particular. I guess I would include their sole or all, you know, if you find all of the current condition or disability is due to the natural progression, some clarification that pulls us out of multiple proximate cause.
You used the term apportion in your first argument. What was it that you were saying was being apportioned?
The amount of damages due to either the injury or the natural progression. That's what the comment to the WIPI talks about, and that's what Torno talks about.
Well, you mean like comparative negligence?
Yeah, like comparative negligence, yes.
Well, but fault is apportioned.
I
damages,
understand.
Damages aren't apportioned. They might be segregated.
I don't practice that area, so I can't speak convincingly. That's how I read the comment, and that's how I read Torno.
It's a significant term of art.
Yeah, I understand
about allocation of fault, which is apportioned.
All I can say is that you don't apportion in workers' comp, and I believe that there is statutory provision for vocational assessments in 095 and in the WACS. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.